move four stations across town. You've got 2 weeks. Go. Oh, and while you're at it, scrounge some equipment to make the STL systems work with an old T1 circuit. And find some time to replace 7 FM transmitters with new solid-state units and full HD radio. That's the world of broadcast engineer Robbie Green. Robbie joins Chris Tobin and me on This Week in Radio Tech. Our show is brought to you by Direct Current Broadcast e-Newsletter. Get Direct Current in your inbox every Thursday with technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. By BSW Broadcast Supply Worldwide, where March is microphone mania. Low mic bundle prices that can't be repeated. And by Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone like that to the light bulb at the top of the tower, like just still sitting over there. I promise you, one day I'm going to make it work. And we talk about all the digital stuff in between, analog, AES, IP packets, structural steel, all the stuff that goes into audio that gets broadcast. Sometimes we talk about audio, too, how to make it better. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. Delighted to be here. As a little disclaimer, I work for the folks at the Telos Alliance. So if you hear a little bias in that direction, please be understanding. But I do know a fair amount about their products and what they can do. So that takes care of that. Hey, my co-host is here with us. It is Chris Tobin, and look where he is. Chris, good afternoon.
Hello, Kirk. Good afternoon. Hello, everyone. Yes, I'm on a rooftop at a radio station here in New Jersey. I thought, why not? It's a beautiful day. Enjoy some of the blue sky. Well, it's starting to get cloudy. And because tomorrow they're calling for crazy weather. So today it's 62 degrees. Tomorrow I believe it's going to be in the 30s. So it's going to be a crazy time. But I'm on the rooftop using technology, something we've talked about. Suncast, if you could throw up that little quick picture so people can appreciate what I'm doing. There it is. There is my link to the land, to the broadband, to the world. There it is. That's a Ubiquiti, a Ubiquiti 5.8 with a little monopole on a mic stand on a rooftop.
Wow.
I'm at the other end of the roof.
What's providing the power over Ethernet to that device?
The power over Ethernet injector downstairs in the TOC.
Okay, so that's your access point, and where you're sitting, you've got your laptop hooked to that access point, yeah?
That's correct. I have the laptop, okay. My phone, a few other things on the access point. I'm stressing it out for fun.
So and now, Chris, you've done this kind of thing before, and you've had a Wi-Fi client, a hardware one, not your laptop, but a client, I guess, picking up the Wi-Fi with your laptop to provide more range, right?
Yes, I did use a point-to-point Ubiquiti, a nano station on one side, that wide, okay. Collinear monopole that you saw in the picture. And yes, yeah. That gave me the opportunity to really focus in where I was, which happened to be just across the street in that park behind me. Last year we did that test.
That's right.
That was the theme was, how do we do an ad hoc revenue-generating broadcast with less than 6 hours worth of notice? That was my idea of the test. It worked.
Gotcha. And now you could do it on even fewer hours than 6 of notice, right?
Yes. Actually, my little travel kit, I can do it probably within about 2 hours. As long as the location we're at has broadband access, we can do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I need to get a. It's inexpensive. I need to get a similar kit too, so I can be prepared if I can. Hey, next week I plan on doing the show from someplace around Gatlinburg, Tennessee. I'm waiting on a call back from a couple of radio stations to see if I can get a little access because we're staying at a resort next week. It's spring break for my son. Wife and I are taking the week off too, and we always have really really bad luck with the Wi-Fi and cellular at the resort we're staying at. So gotta find another place to go.
That's it. Your resort locations are dictated by whether or not you have proper broadband.
Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Yep. All right. Hey, well, our show, it's a war story show. And that means we're going to talk about, you know, being in the trenches, solving problems, getting things done, sometimes under difficult conditions. And very few people have experienced the difficult conditions that our guest has. Let's bring him in from Houston, Texas, and Senior Road. It's Robbie Green. Hey, Robbie, welcome in.
Hey, Kirk. How are you today, man?
We're great. We're great. Glad to have you along. And I see your posts in social media all the time. And you're always doing something, either with the family or with the radio. Seems like you have two lives, family and radio. And that's about it.
That's it. I have my kids, and then I have my electronic kids at work. And yeah, my social media friends, they get a healthy dose of both. So.
So I want to tease a couple of stories you're going to be telling us. We're going to be talking about how to move 4 radio stations in 2 weeks. That's pretty impressive because these were not small market stations. These were medium market stations. You got to move in 2 weeks. Do I have that basically right?
That's exactly right. Yeah.
We're going to talk about ice falling from the tower while you're babysitting the transmitter. And that was a harrowing and, Robbie, go to the transmitter site. You'll be fine. But babysit the transmitter.
Just stay out there. Yeah.
And we got some stories about turning old links into new usable ones. And then we're going to have a magic number of transmitters that you've installed over the past couple of years. And so I'm sure you've got some more stories there. So that's coming up. Our show This Week in Radio Tech, episode 340, is brought to you in part by my friends at the Telos Alliance. And let's have a quick look at their message about direct current.
Not much in the paper today, is there?
Yeah, not much. Seems tough to stay informed, you know?
Like we're missing out on stuff, important stuff.
Yeah, feels like week-old news, yesterday's stories. Half the tech stuff in here seems out of date by the time I see it.
What Kirk doesn't know is I'm way ahead of everyone else around here. Every Thursday, I get this newsletter in my email. It's Direct Current. The folks at the Telos Alliance publish this.
What Joe doesn't know is I keep one step ahead of the radio guys in this market. Every Thursday, I get Direct Current from the folks at the Telos Alliance. It's a free newsletter about radio engineering, audio, streaming, studios, everything.
Thursday afternoons, we have our department head meeting. I look like a genius, thanks to the knowledge, updates, and advice in Direct Current. Sometimes I wonder if I should tell Kirk about Direct Current. Might help him out.
I wonder if I should let Joe in on my secret. He could use a little help sometimes.
Get Direct Current in your inbox every Thursday. Read profiles of engineers and newsmakers in the broadcast community. Get technical pointers putting you and your facility at an advantage. Important industry news and views. Plus, you'll be up to date on Telos Omnia Axia and ZipString products. It's all here in the Direct Current newsletter. Subscribe online at telosalliance.com/directcurrent. That's telosalliance.com/directcurrent.
And in this week's Direct Current, just showed up in my mailbox a few hours ago, actually 3 hours ago. There's an article about a brand new product from Telos called the TVC-15. It's a watermark analyzer and monitor, and it monitors a whole lot more frequently than just once every minute, like you may have been used to if you are in a market where watermarking is done. And there's a great article from Shane Toven with advice over standards-based signal distribution over IP, like AES-67. That's audio monitoring in the transition to AOIP. So Direct Current, there's another article too, and a few more links. And so check it all out in Direct Current. Go and sign up. All right. This Week in Radio Tech, episode 340, War Stories. And I think we should just jump right into it. Robbie, I think, is ready to tell us about this studio move that happened. What was this, a couple of years ago, Robbie?
Yeah, it was about 3 years ago now, and it was actually in a medium market, just like you said. Had a situation where my previous employer, we had to vacate a studio building pretty quickly. We had an environmental problem, so to speak, with this building due to a little bit of negligence on the building owner's part. Wasn't the radio company, but. Anyway, we ended up having to move the studios in 2 weeks. We had a little prep time before that. Actually brought a whole bunch of audio over IP gear, a bunch of Axia consoles, and also an OpEx automation system. We converted them from one automation platform to another, all at the same time, and basically got everything set up and running in what was then my live performance studio here in Houston at my previous job. And then we hauled it all to the market, got it all put in and up and running within 2 weeks.
Did you pre-configure studios in a different market?
Yes, yeah. All the equipment we actually had delivered here to Houston, pulled everything out of the boxes, got everything assembled and put together. And then we programmed all the Axia gear and got the automation, all programmed. We'd had the market send us, their audio libraries and everything, their song libraries and whatnot on hard drive, got everything ready to go in there. So we got the automation up and running. We got the Axia gear all up and running. In fact, we were using the audio over IP drivers from Axia for the rollout and everything. Got everything programmed and it was all ready to go, and then we just wrapped everything in moving blankets and hauled it down the road.
So I'm not going to promote one AOIP standard over another. I think everybody knows where I stand, where my bread's buttered, and I've been singing this tune for a dozen years or more now. But tell me, you mentioned when we talked a couple days ago that it really was AOIP that made this possible for you to pre-configure everything with fairly simple connections, just network connections, not a bunch of Belden 8451 wire stripped and punched down. It was really AOIP that made this possible for you to do.
Yeah, and it was actually just that simple. When I say we had the 2 week time frame to get in there and everything, we had to do quite a bit of work. We had to put together satellite dish, the studio furniture, everything, and basically slam them all together. But basically, audio over IP and the structured wiring that we had put in by the general contractor did the rebuild of the facility, that was really the key. Because if we were having to do a traditional studio build where we had done everything with regular analog or even digital consoles, some of the first generation pre AOIP type digital consoles, it would have been much more difficult to pull this off. And we did it. We had a team of about five guys. We got in there, got it all built, and we moved a bunch of radio stations over a 2 week period.
You mentioned something that we don't hit on very often when we're thinking about audio over IP, switching to an IP-based infrastructure, and that is having a contractor do your infrastructure wiring. So do all the cabling through the walls, all the stuff that we as engineers, honestly, I'm not very good at. I do a sloppy job at it. I end up breaking ceilings and making holes in walls bigger than they need to be because I don't have the tools and techniques to do that infrastructure cabling really well. And I want to ask Chris Tobin about this. Some years ago, when Axia was about 5 years old, we had been talking about, hey, your cabling becomes a lot easier, fewer cables, you can have a contractor do this. And I got a couple of interesting different takes on this. One, Robbie, was the take that you just said, that you could hire a contractor to do your wiring. And I know our friends at Minnesota Public Radio, for example, did the same thing. They had a ton of wiring to do. They hired a contractor who just pulled and terminated Ethernet cables. Now, with the engineers I spoke with in New York City, it was a little bit different story. Instead of telling me we hired a contractor, the answer more often than not was I did it myself, because hiring a contractor in New York City can involve a lot of red tape. Chris, maybe I heard that wrong. Would you give me your take on contractor versus do-it-yourself and AOIP
Sure.
making it possible to do yourself in a big place like New York City?
Well, it depends. In New York City, you have various different jurisdictions regarding contract work, building managements, and how they manage construction projects, we'll call them. So if you're in a building that has labor-represented contractors, plumbers, electricians, things of that nature, then you're probably beholden in your lease to hire that type of work. So there are some buildings, yes, you would have to have a contractor come in. The nice thing about the AOIP infrastructure is that you can hire any of these contractors that do telecommunications work, and you spec out what you need, and they don't have to worry about converting it to broadcast knowledge or broadcast design. You just tell them I need, Cat 5, Cat 6, whatever drops you're doing. I need horizontal cabling. I'm going to do fiber between the switches. And they'll package it together, give you a price, and you can compete. You can actually get a very good price depending on how you go about it. Or if you're fortunate enough to be in a location where you can do it yourself, again, you still can get off-the-shelf infrastructure materials and do it very, very cleanly. I know the installation that I did, we were in a building that we had to hire an outside contractor to bring in the cabling and do all that work. Mm-hmm. It was a CBS property in New York. So we had to do that. But the good thing is it's considered low voltage. So when you're working with the contractors, you don't have to worry about it being huge, huge pricing based on like electrical contractor work. It's more of the telecommunications pricing model. So that's the reason for it. It's not that it's difficult in New York. It's just there are certain natural business restrictions. And if you work within them, you'll be fine. The great thing about it is Robbie pointed out, you didn't have to worry about the, we'll call it the 25 pair Krone block or 66 block installations that we're all familiar with. Yeah. If you bought a PR&E console, Wheatstone or Ward Beck. So, you know, that would have required, if you did have to go with a contractor, that would require a little extra work. You'd have to educate them on how to pull it, where to bring it down, how to terminate it, which way you go with it. You know, what riser cables or riser pegs, cable harnessing you do, cable management gets a little, that could get a little expensive because they have no idea what you're talking about. But with Cat 5, Cat 6, you're in no problem.
Yeah, and a lot of people do this. So it's become very, very common to find contractors who do this, which the competition hopefully holds the pricing to something reasonable. You're not paying an arm and a leg for a specialized contractor. I mean, there's people pulling Cat 5 and Cat 6 through every office in America.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the great thing about it is it's not specialized in the sense that you're stuck with one. There's a directory full of folks that can do this, and they all are based on certain criteria, both for pricing, labor cost, and parts of time and materials. So you can literally shop around. Whereas if we were doing the traditional Belden 25 pair audio cabling for analog days, 66 block, split block, or this block, whatever, you'd find you only had maybe one or two companies that can manage that if they were familiar with 1A2 phone systems. Then you had a good chance of them getting the 25-pair cable correct.
Yeah.
Nowadays, you don't have to worry about that. That's what's great about this whole thing.
So I was just thinking, Robbie and Chris, I was just thinking about, okay, we do so many things over IP nowadays, and we're putting more gear that is powered over the Ethernet as well. I was just at a transmitter site a couple of weeks ago where they had to put some IP radios way up the tower. Because there are some hills between the downtown Nashville area and this tower south of town. So there are some STL dishes that are at the 500 to almost 800-foot level. Well, that's beyond the reach of traditional copper Ethernet. And so they had to do fiber conversion at the bottom of the tower and at the IP radio. And they had to run 48 volts all the way up the tower. Now, that's still cheaper than running waveguide, or an IDU, ODU system for IP radios. So they elected to do this. What if someday we can put the FM transmitter right there at the antenna base and somehow, I don't know how you get the power up there, maybe 48 volts on one leg and the other leg of the tower. But wouldn't that be cool?
They actually have some of those here. There are some translators here in Houston where, like this tower that I'm sitting under, it actually has three platforms. There's one at 800 feet, one at 1,200 feet, and one at 1,400 feet. And there's some two-way radio gear up there. There's RPU stuff. Not a lot of it's still in use these days, but there is some RPU stuff up there. The transmitters for some of the translators that have come into Houston that are out in this area, I hear they're up on the platforms. I haven't seen any personally, but I know they're out there.
Sure. And so now those are probably operating just with power up there. Do they have some remote control going to those levels?
They do. On the tower here, I forget how many pair we have going to each platform. But, there is, something like 50 pair going up to each platform for control stuff and also for telco. As a matter of fact, back in the day when I was still using some RPU gear, we actually had a traditional, dial-up remote control that we used to turn the IFB transmitter on and off. Up there. So yeah, that's how we do it.
Wow. Yeah, I don't think I've worked at stations where we had headgear way up the tower, but I haven't worked on towers that were all that tall. So it made more sense to have that gear down at the base of the tower. Did work at one where we had an STL at the base of the tower outside the building. I didn't plan that, but that's what was there when I got there, and it worked okay until it got really cold. And we kept a light bulb on in the metal box to keep the transmitter a little bit warm. It was an old Marty. I think it was an RPT-8, one of those STL transmitters that would multiply your frequency by who knows, six or so to get up to the 950 band. Okay, so we covered the Baton Rouge. I mean, what did you learn in moving these studios in Baton Rouge in that 2 week period of time? Did you walk away with oh my gosh, we got to do this at every studio build we do now?
Well, you know, it was my first where I was kind of the lead for the project AOIP rollout. I would say that, the, you know, the one thing that it kind of came to me was I have to do every build out now AOIP. It really spoiled me to a pretty large extent. It just went so smoothly, and we were able to pull off everything so much more quickly than we would have been able to with even the last generation. Like my studios in Houston at the time, you know, were based on a TDM router, you know, and everything, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. great. I mean, it's great technology, it's bulletproof, but just being able to get everything done as quickly as I did, it was a real eye opener for me, and something that I personally hadn't experienced up to that point. So it was a great project, and everything I can do AOIP now, I do AOIP because it just seems to work well, and the speed and efficiency just can't be matched.
Let's keep on the AOIP theme. We'll get to the transmitters after our next commercial break. Robbie, you were telling me that for AOIP, for some remote kit that you built for some really kind of a complicated remote, you chose to go with a Dante connected system. Why don't you tell us about what your assignment was, what you had to come up with, and then how you selected the gear to make that happen with this remote kit?
Sure. Basically, we have a sports station here, which is very, very active. It's the flagship station for the Houston Texans radio network, and our remote gear for that station was getting a little long in the tooth, and you know, basically, it was time to freshen things up, and the old remote kit was actually based upon a snake, you know, audio snake, and we had like cough boxes and little headphone amps, but it was just this mess of wiring that went out everywhere. I'd become familiar with these boxes made by a company called Studio Technologies that basically you could use for as talent consoles. They're used a lot of different places, apparently more so in TV than radio broadcast, talking to the guys at Studio Technologies. But they work really well, and basically it has a mic input, an on-off switch for the mic, and then they can create their own mix minus basically in the, for their headphones and everything, control their own volume into their headphones, their return audio from the station and everything. And basically the kit that we put together uses Dante. That's the interconnect technology. And each talent console is PoE powered from a network switch, and it just plugs right in there. So instead of having a mess of, snake, and then we have, mic cable and headphone cable and everything, going out to every station at a broadcast nowadays, we plug in, one Ethernet cable. We actually use hardened Ethernet cable. It's mm-hmm. Neutrik EtherCon connectors, and I forget exactly what the Cat 6 wiring is, but it's pretty stout, and you just plug it in, and the remote that used to take maybe 30 to 45 minutes to set up, you can set up with one guy in 10 minutes now. It's very fast and very efficient, and it works really well.
Yeah, so this notion of having the talent have so much control on a remote is pretty cool. So you said they can control their volume level. How much? What of the other people they hear? They can have like more me and more everybody else, or less everybody else. And then a mute button. Yeah.
Yeah. There's on off cough on mm-hmm. the way we have it configured. There's on off cough, and you can also set it up where the cough button is also a talk back button if they need to talk back to a producer or to the studio mm-hmm. or whatever. That's also all over Dante. That's it. The boxes just have three knobs right on the front. You plug in your headsets, I think the knob on the far left is the headphone volume, and the one in the middle is left or right balance, and then the one on the far right is actually the balance between the return audio and your own local audio.
And, gotcha. So does each talent gets their own mix minus?
they get their own mix minus. You know, basically, we actually have a Dante feed for each box going back to each one that is a mix of everything at the broadcast except that talent console. The console that we actually use for this, it's a Soundcraft, I want to say it's an Expression SI, and it's a rack mount unit. It's the smallest unit they make, but and you have to get a Dante plug-in card for the back of it. And they have a few different AOIP cards for it, you know, that you can actually plug a few different audio standards into it, you know, Dante being one of them. I forget what the others are because I was more interested in the Dante application, but it works real well.
Cool. Chris, have you gotten to use any other of the AOIP standards and remote kits or studio builds?
Yeah, I've used Dante at BB King's in New York City. We did a recording of a music group, some multi-track. So it was pretty cool to be able to walk in, have a laptop, it was a MacBook with the Dante software and stuff on it, plug in the LAN connection from the network, and then appear on their network, and they can feed us whatever mix we needed, and the buses, the ISOs, and everything, and it was very handy. It sure beat lugging out the Yamaha consoles we have. We would do the same thing with the MADI interface. So now we have our laptop with Dante and MADI, so we could do a MADI if we had to. It works out really well. And the studio technology stuff I've used, and Robbie's right, it's really good stuff. It works really well. The nice thing about it, it's streamlined, so it does the job you need for the workflow. So you don't have to worry about getting crazy. And you can get set up real quick, and you can strike real fast, depending on the event you're doing. So it's the AOIP technologies, I will say this again. I've been saying it for years. You know this, Kirk. You're only limited by your imagination.
Yeah. Hey, Robbie, when I was looking online at the Studio Technologies boxes you mentioned, and we'll put a link in the show notes, I noticed that the bottom cover is removable and there's some dip switches in there. Is that part of configuring these boxes for the Dante network?
It definitely is. You know, in terms of the Dante stuff going into and out of the box, you know, basically with the dip switches, and this is from memory, it's been about 8 months since I've even been into these things. But there's a lot of different options. You can set the mic gain in there. One thing I would caution you about, the one thing that we learned kind of on the fly with this, is you can set the mic gain to a point where you get some clipping. And of course, you know, the digital clipping is a lot less forgiving than good old-fashioned analog clipping. So that was one real early lesson we learned. You know, so under that that panel there, you have mic gain. You have you know, a lot of different options. Like I said, you can configure that second button on it either to be a cough button or a talk back, and that's what those different dip switches are for.
Ah, okay, gotcha. So does the box have an IP address?
The box, if I recall correctly, does. It actually has a Dante interface in it, and you know, they each one of those has an IP address, and you know, goes back to the console, and they all talk to each other.
Cool. Hey, before we take our last break, let's cover one other little thing you did in the trenches. You had a T1 circuit in place, but T1's not what you needed, and you ended up. Somehow you made it like Ethernet. Tell us about this adventure and what problem you solved with it.
Yeah, it was actually part of that real fast studio move that we were talking about earlier. Basically, we had to move their existing STL situation from the old studio to the new studio and have them both online because we weren't doing a flash cut of all these stations. We moved them, you know, basically one got moved in the morning, one got moved in the evening over a period of a couple of days. And anyway, long story short, we had their regular STL, all their studio transmitter link, the RF links, were co-located at one FM transmitter site, and because they couldn't actually get STL shots out of their old studio location. So basically, we had the T1 in there from the old studios. We moved their you know, system they had used for the T1 from the old studios to the new studios and reconfigured that box to actually work with the Ethernet private line. from I believe the provider was Windstream on that one. And so anyway, we moved that over, got it reconfigured, ready to go. It was a WorldNet Oslo, if I remember correctly. And then we actually had some Intraplex frames that we used with three sets of Zephyr Extremes, Telos Zephyr Extremes, operating in IP mode. And it was really cool because we were able to set those up to do basically 256K AAC, which is actually, you know, higher bandwidth than you can do on an ISDN connection those boxes. It sounded great, and it worked really well. We basically had the T1 frame set up to do all IP data. It was, of course, controlled QoS because we, you know, had the T1. And, we just, set that up, and it was the T1 for quite a while. It worked out real well.
So you made a T1 by putting the Intraplex frames on there, made an Ethernet path, and then hooked your Zephyr Extremes onto that in IP mode.
It was a slow Ethernet connection, 1.544 megabits per second, but it was enough bandwidth for the connections. It worked great.
Cool. And of course,
One cool thing. I was just going to say, one thing, particularly here, we just found out from Ma Bell, we got a present real recently that we opened up the phone bill and found out that our ISDN lines here have gone up from $87 a month each to $575 a month each.
Jiminy Christmas.
So I think there's going to be a lot of Zephyr Extremes that might need to find new uses, and hold on to those boxes because if you're ever in a need where you need an IPSTL or whatever, and you have a QoS circuit, they work great in that application.
Yeah, a lot of folks don't know that the Zephyr Extreme it was built for ISDN, but it was Telos's first foray into IP audio connectivity with compressed audio, and they're not flexible like a Telos Zip 1, but if you've got a path and you can point to the IP at the other path and it's a good path, then it'll work.
It does work.
I know of a room in New York City where there's about 70 of them. They're encoding a lot of audio. Hey, we're going to take a quick break here. And when we come back, Robbie Green is our guest. It's a War Stories episode of This Week in Radio Tech. Chris Tobin is along from a beautiful courtyard in New York, in New Jersey, wherever he is. I don't know. Where are you at, Chris? Can you tell us?
I'm a rooftop of an FM radio station in Newark, New Jersey, a jazz station.
There you go. Nice rooftop.
Yeah.
Is there a Starbucks up there on the roof?
Not on the roof, but just across the way I can see it. So I can actually I can place an order on the web, have somebody pick it up and bring it back.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Hey, we had RF transmission stories coming up with Robbie Green here in just a second. Our show's brought to you in part by BSW, Broadcast Supply Worldwide, and it is Mic Mania Month. In March Mic Mania Month. Well, that's a lot of M's at BSW. And look, here's the deal. I just got my catalog. It looks just like the ad you're seeing right there. Up to 61% off on select microphones and mic bundles. Now, it's the bundles that are really helpful here because you get the stuff you really need. You get the shock mount and a pop filter. You may get an XLR cable depending on the bundle. But seriously, if you're looking to get an RE20 from ElectroVoice or the RE320 or the RE27ND, any of those mics, they're big-time broadcast standard microphones, sound great. If you're looking to get one of those, let me let you in on a little secret. Right now is the time. And I'm not allowed to tell you why it won't be the time later on, but you're going to pay more later. How about that? You're going to pay more later. It's quite possible that you'll never be able to get those microphones at this price again. You can get a package discount with a RE pop filter, a 309A shock mount, and the BSW broadcast XLR cable, and they are quite a savings that you will not see again. So take my word for it. Also, 10% off the Yellowtech IXM Pro mic bundles. Use the promo code YELLOW in all caps. If you go to the website and order the IXM from Yellowtech, that's the handheld recording microphone that has so many cool features. It's just awesome. You'll always get great recordings from that mic. Also, the Audio-Technica BP40 broadcast mic package. That's $349, including the microphone, windscreen, shock mount, and XLR cable. And then, hey, one of my favorites, you know, the Heil PR40 broadcast mic package. That's $349, and that includes the mic, the PRS-MB shock mount, which is a great shock mount, the RE pop filter, the HB1 boom arm, and the XLR cable. All of that for $349. You know, when you get a mic, you need a mic processor, too. You need a preamp, and a processor will help you a lot. I can personally highly recommend one that they have on sale. It's an extra $30 off. It's the DBX286S mic processor. You're listening to one right now. My voice comes through that. I record all my audio for video with that, books on tape for Audible. All the stuff that I do with my mic goes through the 286S mic processor. It's an extra $30 off. And BSW can ship later in the day than anyone. Up to 7 p.m. Eastern time for any item in stock that is in stock at their Ohio warehouse, which is almost everything they sell is in stock at the Ohio warehouse. So get in touch with them up to 7 p.m. Eastern time. It can ship out that same evening. All right. Check it out. They've been in business since 1973. Huge warehouse and yada yada on the mailing list. See, I got my Mike Mania right here. Everybody loves this catalog. Everybody loves their website because it's the reference go-to website, the best one in the business. BSWUSA.com. Thanks a lot to BSW Broadcast Supply Worldwide for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Kirk Harnack here along with Chris Tobin in Newark, New Jersey on a beautiful rooftop. Hey, Chris, just Chris and Robbie, let's talk about the weather for just a second before we get into our war stories with transmitters. So here in Nashville, 75 degrees high temperature today recorded here at the Harnack Weather Station. And it's been a glorious, beautiful day. Started out with clear blue skies. A few clouds are coming in. We're going to have some rain overnight. In fact, some of it could be heavy. Temperature will drop a little bit tomorrow. And then look out for Saturday here in Nashville. The snow starts up about 11 a.m. or noon in Nashville. And in north of I-40 throughout Middle Tennessee, they're predicting upwards of 2 inches of snow. In fact, about a 60% probability of 2 inches, a 70% probability of 1 inch. And the family and I are headed over to East Tennessee to the mountains where we could get up to 4 inches of snow before it's done on Saturday night. So, hey, if you're anywhere north of I-40 in the middle part of the country, your chances of getting some snow and maybe a little bit of ice are pretty good. Chris, what's your forecast looking like there?
Well, today's high was 61 degrees. It was blue skies. It was very comfortable. The wind has shifted, though. It's coming out from the north, and the temperature is dropping quickly. And they're calling for tomorrow, well, later this evening, it'll start to rain, turning into sleet, then possibly up to 3 inches of snow, maybe four. However, the ground temperature may be still a little too warm, so the streets may not get snowbound, but probably very slushy. So by tomorrow midday, tomorrow Friday, we probably will have several inches on the ground here in the New York metro. So we're north of you, so we're going to get snow also.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of snow. How about Robbie? No snow for Houston, is there? I wouldn't think so.
It snowed once since I've lived here. I've lived here since 2007. Yeah, it was big, fluffy snowflakes for about 5 minutes. No, lots of rain. It's been wet here, and I think we have more thunderstorms on the way. And right now it is it's 78, which it's been 78 pretty much all day long. So,
Well, you have other problems there. Hey, years ago when I was a kid, I lived in Lafayette, Louisiana, about the same. Well, no, so you may be a little farther south, not much. And I remember the snowflakes, kindergarten, huge snowflakes. We went crazy. Then 5 minutes later, it was done.
Yes, yes. I've spent some time in Lafayette. That's where my wife's from. So,
do you guys get ice storms in Houston at all?
You know, it can happen. Like this tower here, we have an ice bridge. Of course, there is ice protection on top of the transmitter building. Can happen. I will tell you that our aux site next door, there are a bunch of big satellite dishes right under the tower. They survive. They don't seem to have any problems. It doesn't happen here all that often. I mean, it happens, but it's not like other places.
Gotcha. Chris, I'm looking at, weather geek here. I'm looking at the 3 kilometer HRRR forecast for radar returns. And yeah, you're going to get a few starting up and then within about 12, 12 to 15 hours from now, you're going to get walloped with some rain, sure enough. But I guess you knew that.
Yeah. I've been checking the radar and watching. I'm just as crazy weather geek as anybody else who's in this business. I have a transmitter site in Manhattan, though icing does occur, and we've had issues with snow and ice up there. And studios are located in New Jersey that there are times when they say, oh, we'll just be a dusting, and we come back to 6 inches. So I'm being prepared for the worst. Because yeah. I can't sometimes figure out, I don't have access to all the models, but apparently now everybody who looks at the models gets to interpret them properly.
Yeah. Well, just remember, they're models. They're not guarantees. They're just models.
I understand. But I've worked with a couple of meteorologists who are very accurate, but they understood the models. They explained to me the science behind it, and I said, so that's the difference. So
I can tell you, if you're in the southeast United States, Tennessee, Kentucky, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, Florida, in the next 15 hours, you are getting wet. It's almost guaranteed, at least, in the 70-80% chance there, because this system is moving through, blowing through, blowing up, and spreading out. And it looks like some heavy, heavy rain for us here in Middle Tennessee. So, all right, let's jump into FM transmitters. I love putting in transmitters. Is there anything like that new transmitter smell? Well, when you turn it on, you hope it doesn't smell, because maybe you left something in place. I remember years ago, I put a Nautel transmitter on the air, an AM one, and we turned it on, and not a single meter moved, because they all had shorting clips across them for safety. Somehow I missed that step. Remove the shorting clips.
I've done something similar on their current FM boxes. There's an inhibit switch on each of the RF modules. And the ones that we get here typically have 16 RF pallets. I mean, not RF pallets, but RF modules, which have four pallets in each one. But but there's an inhibit switch. And the last GV30 that I put in, I got it all put in. I wired it up. I hit the go button. And nothing happens. And I'm like, what happened? And what's funny, I hate to admit this. This is terribly embarrassing, but it's happened to me twice now. I put in two GVs, forget to flip the inhibit switch on each of the RF modules, the 16 RF modules. And I hit the go button. Nothing happens. And then I go back. I'm like, oh, man, I did it again. And then flip the switches and transmitter comes to life and everybody's happy, But yeah, it happens.
Talk to us about, first of all, you've replaced seven transmitters. Are all these for the same radio station owner, or is this a couple of different owners you've been working?
Well, in the last couple of years, it's been a lot of Nautels, and they've all been for CBS radio. Basically, company's been trying to get away from the tube transmitters, which, there's a lot of reasons to in this day and age. The tube prices are increasing. Reliability has been a little bit shaky for a lot of people, and everything. So, we've been moving away from it, which is actually, it's an awesome, awesome thing. And, basically, I've done seven installs. I'm actually doing the eighth one right now. Interestingly enough, I put in some NVs that were ordered for this market prior to me joining the company that were not installed until I got here. They were sitting actually in this combiner room, a lot of them. Put those in, and then the GV series came on the scene and started taking a look at the power consumption, efficiency, things like that, and also going a little bit higher power on our HD radio. HD radio. We are doing low-level combining now, replaced a bunch of first-generation HD transmitters that are still sitting in the room. They're just not actually doing anything anymore. We went that route, and we put a bunch in. I actually had some NVs that I installed, and I've since moved over to our AUX site, which is actually right next door. But the efficiency difference between the NV series Nautels and the GV series Nautels made that attractive. We're saving about somewhere between $600 and $700 a month on the power bill by going with the GVs. They're a lot more their power consumption is just that much lower than the NV series. They're both great boxes. It's just I'm glad that Nautel came out with the GVs later on because they're so much more efficient.
Are the GV transmitters now? Back up. Are most or all of your stations running some HD channels?
They are all running HD channels. Mm-hmm. Our AMs are not HD, but all the FMs are. We're running at least HD2. Some of them are running HD3s. Right now, all four of the CBS FMs and one of the other owners here in Houston on the same tower, we have all gone from minus 20 dBc up to minus 14 dBc. So quite a bit more HD power. Not as high as we can because, we could go all the way up to minus 10 on some of these. Of course, others are limited by other, stations that are around and everything. You know how all that fits together. But mm-hmm. the transmission line on the tower, this is what we can actually do. All the all nine stations on the Senior Road Tower can go up to minus 14 dBc. And actually, without us having to upgrade the transmission line, and we can stay within 100% safety margin, which the transmitter or not the transmitter, but the combiner manufacturer wants to do. If we all want to go up to minus 10 at some point in the future, we have to upgrade the transmission line.
So, are you what level of combining are you doing? Is all this taking place in the GV transmitters, or are you doing something else with combined?
It is. We've gone to low level combined. There's actually a dual input on the antenna system here, the HD stuff was going up two separate feed lines. It still is for four of the stations here at Senior Road. Five of the stations have actually gone low level combined, us and then there's a station owned by Cox Radio here. They actually just put in a water cooled transmitter. A Gates Ear, and it's really neat to see that. That's the first one I've actually seen. We've all gone to minus 14, and we're all doing low level combined. The first generation rigs that are still in use here, I think one more station definitely is retiring theirs, and they are going to go to a low level combined system later this year. But we are, we had the first, and then we put in all four of ours and went to that. And recently Cox made the move here as well.
For my little small market stations, we're finally really seriously considering some HD. We've never done it before. When it first started out through the first generation, second generation, it seemed, well, first of all, it was expensive for small market stations. And second of all, it seemed so complicated, the what you had to do to get there, to get to transmit HD. The transmitters themselves hadn't caught up with the technology, so you had to do different kinds of combining, and people came up with various solutions along the way. And now that we're able to do low-level combining and amplify that just seems so much easier to do. If I were to jump in, or other engineers listening who've not done HD yet, if they were to jump into this now, is it much more understandable? Can this really get done by buying a new transmitter that's HD ready?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the thing. I mean, basically it's all very straightforward. There's a little bit of a learning curve, but it's nothing too extreme. I mean, anybody who's installed or been in part of like an automation system install, or, even we're talking audio IP stuff these days, you can totally do, an HD install these days. You have your exporter, your importer, right up to the transmitter, literally, and particularly these GV boxes. There are two network ports on the Exporter Plus that Nautel has, and you just take one Ethernet cable, plug it right into the back of the exciter, and that's all there is to it. You don't even have to run the connection back to the network switch. You can if you want to, and in fact, I had a problem with an Exporter Plus and ended up putting the exporter software, the newer version of it, on an older first generation exporter, was able to get us going in a pinch last year. It's very straightforward, and it's something you can definitely do, or the guys at Nautel, I'm sure support would be happy to talk you through it. If you're buying a box.
Yeah, I've always dealt with the audio processing side of it with the guys, with Omnia and the TELUS Alliance. Haven't gotten my hands in the RF. I've watched it and gone, wow, it's a lot of stuff, a lot to worry about. But it's looking easier now.
It's a lot less now. We've been removing a lot of the circulators from the combiner that you see behind me for the first generation rigs and everything. And yeah, it's a lot easier doing the low level these days. And the signal quality, it's fantastic. I can actually drive from here, from this tower, all the way to College Station, Texas, if you want to look at a map. not have a dropout on HD2 until I get pretty close to the College Station city limits. So it goes a long way.
So you've installed 7 transmitters in the last couple of years. Kind of walk us through, because a lot of other engineers have either been in your shoes or in your position or are going to be. I've still got a few tube transmitters. Eventually, when we can afford to, we're going to replace those. What are some of the considerations? And I would think it's mostly a happy thing to get rid of all that air handling, or a lot of it. There's still air handling, I guess, in an air-cooled solid state. But kind of walk us through the considerations that you think about. You know, GM calls you up and says, hey, remember that last transmitter, the tube one we haven't replaced yet? We got budget for that. We're going to replace that. What do you start doing at that point, Robbie?
Well, actually, we're kind of in the middle of that right now. We're looking at possibly doing some revisions to the air handling for this entire facility. Basically, our aux site's about as simple as it comes. There's 60 tons of air conditioning in that room, and all the transmitters dump directly into that room. We're kind of doing the same thing here now, but in the past, all the tube transmitters, basically, there was a chimney or whatever, and it went right up into the exhaust ductwork. We just removed that. And we're actually dumping into the room now. The solid state transmitters, actually the temperature rise and everything is not as high as it was with the tube boxes, and certainly a lot more distributed than it was with the tube boxes, particularly with the Nautel GBs. The NVs, run a little bit hotter, but the GBs not, it's funny. The biggest problem I had with one of those, I was in doing some work in that transmitter, the first one, mm-hmm. That room, I installed it in the middle of winter, and I was freezing my butt off in there. I was actually, I was uncomfortably cold after getting the GB on the air, and I was doing some other work in the room. It's basically the airflow is much greater, at least with the Nautels. I'm sure it's probably a similar situation with the Gates air boxes and the other manufacturers. But that's kind of the big consideration, is what do you do with the air? Whereas especially like back in the day, you might have exhausted it straight outside, especially in more northern areas where you might not even have air conditioning at the transmitter site. Not a thing that we can do here, obviously, because of the heat and humidity. But we've been dumping it into the rooms, but we are actually looking at the possibility of maybe converting this, and we're going to probably do a study with a mechanical engineer, in the coming year, to determine the feasibility of converting this to a closed system, because it's turned out that we are actually dumping quite a bit of cold air outside these days. And, where the exhaust temp on the side of the building might have been, 150, 160 degrees, before. Now it's, if you go outside and it's the middle of summer and you stand underneath the main exhaust for the Senior Road facility, because we have a shared HVAC system between all mm-hmm. 9 stations here, it's cool. It's comfortable. You can stand under there and it's like, it's refreshing. It's like being in the building. So we're looking at doing something different with that, and it's probably going to drop our AC costs, quite a bit in terms of the electric and everything. So, it's just a lot more airflow in a lot less concentrated area. And that's kind of the consideration. For us, it was just a matter of opening up the ductwork. There was really nothing else we could do because of the shared HVAC system here. One thing that we did do just in case, we actually put in a supplemental 5-ton unit into each of our suites out here. Some of the other suites had that already. We do have problems with the HVAC system out here occasionally, so it's nice to have that backup as well. But we don't depend on it. Our stations don't actually kick on the 5-ton units most of the time. Most of the time, we just rely on the shared HVAC for the whole facility.
Well, yeah, and one thing we've talked about it on the show before, because our friend Michael Patton, contract engineer from Louisiana, really pointed this out. We converted a transmitter site that has three tube transmitters in it into a closed system, because once you factor in, of course, if you're blowing air out, whether it's cool or warm, if you're blowing air out, you're sucking air in the same amount. And that air you're bringing in is moist. And that moisture has a latent heat, because water carries heat very well. And so if you factored in the latent heat of the air that we were sucking in, of course, especially during the summertime, hot and humid, we were really only paying about 10% more for a totally closed system than for a system where we evacuated the hot air from the transmitters. And that 10% we determined was worth it for us for longevity and a lot less dust and all that kind of stuff. So even more so with your new transmitters, don't dump cold air outside because you got to suck, you know, moisturized air from the outside to bring it in. And that's it.
And mm-hmm. and in this facility, when you look at the exhaust pipe for the condensers and everything, literally in the middle of summer in Houston, it looks like a garden hose. The water just running out of it. We're condensing that much moisture out of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
And that's the way they had to do it here back in the day. But now with most broadcasters on the tower going to the solid state units, it just doesn't make sense for us to maintain that anymore. And so we're looking to revise that in the real near future.
So Chris, I haven't gotten the opportunity to remove a tube transmitter and put a solid state in its place. Well, with AM I have, but I haven't gotten to do that with FMs yet, except for little rack mount units. Chris, do you have any comments to dovetail with Robbie's comments before we go to break?
No, I totally agree. I've gone through tube changes to solid state. Experienced the same exact thing where the room temperature during the winter months was very comfortable with the tube transmitter. Then we went solid state and realized it's now time to install a heater. So yeah, no, I know exactly what he's talking about. Scales of economy. Yeah. The efficiencies that you need to look at is what's important. And the newer technologies are making it real easy. And you have to rethink everything. If you're in a legacy facility, if you're doing it new, you got a great opportunity if you're using solid state transmitters.
Yeah. Yep. All good all the way around. All right. Hey, guys, right after the break, we've got left our tips of the week from each of you. Robbie, I think I warned you about this. We need something that our listeners and viewers can walk away with saying, you know, that Robbie's a pretty smart guy. That's a good idea he had. So we'll be back with you.
I think I have one.
Good. And Chris never disappoints. He's always ready. I mean, you can shake him out of a dead sleep and he'll have a tip of the week ready for you right then. Just amazing. Our show is brought to you in part by the folks at Lavvo. Now, most of you know me, Kirk Harnack, as a broadcast engineer. Well, an adequate one anyway. An on-air personality, once again, an adequate one. And the host of TWRT. Well, what you may not know is that I have had the wonderful opportunity to travel around the world and sell broadcast equipment. And that brought me into a lot of facilities, studios and transmitter sites all around the world. Really, some of them kind of crazy, scary stuff, and a lot of them pretty amazing as well. Well, this is one of the reasons, because I've seen so many facilities, that I'm excited to introduce you to our sponsor, Lavvo, Lavvo.com, a German company. And Lavvo's famous around the world for their television, audio, and video, especially in these high-profile events like the Olympics, the Grammy Awards, and World Cup soccer. When the broadcast is mission critical, you're pretty likely to find Lavvo there. Now, you wouldn't believe how this stuff is built. Everything is really over-engineered, a lot of redundancy. In some cases, the backups have backups because there really are no do-overs in live event broadcasting, and dead air in those can kill your career. Well, now you may be thinking, why should I care? I'm not doing TV. I'm not doing the Grammys. Well, radio guys do hate dead air even more than TV guys, which is why broadcasters like the BBC, CBC, and NPR, to name a few, buy Lavvo radio consoles. Now, since they're this involved in TV and radio around the world, it means that Lavvo is thinking a lot about the future, too. Everyone knows that all types of media are converging into a common IP delivery platform. Hey, we're talking about it on this show again. And Lavvo is ready for that with broadcast gear that can handle audio, video, and control of every studio device using a single off-the-shelf computer network. And after that, well, there's virtualization coming, broadcasting from the cloud where you're controlling stuff that is off-site and in a secure data center. Lavvo is building those tools as well. So if bulletproof reliability, 5 nines of uptime, and being future-proof are important to you, then check it out. Go to lavvo.com/twrt, and I'd appreciate if you go to that extra little website there. Go to Lavvo, Lavvo.com/twirt. And that'll give us a little credit. It'll show that you listen to the show, and you will find out more about Lavvo's offerings. Thanks a lot to Lavvo for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right. It's time for a tip of the week. First of all, from war story warrior, Robbie Green, who's been installing transmitters and building studios like crazy for the last couple of years. Robbie, what kind of tip do you have for us?
I would say the one thing I would say at this point is to check out Ethernet private line if you have any kind of a T1 STL. You might find out that the quality is better than what you're seeing from the phone company. And, you can get more bandwidth and pump more channels of audio through one pipe than you could with the traditional T1 type setup. And we're doing that here. We're actually carrying all our audio out to this facility on a pair of Axia nodes. Switched to that about, I guess it's been about 7 or 8 months ago. And it has worked spectacularly well. The one thing I would say, though, is definitely check pricing. Unlike the T1, which is kind of a commodity thing with the phone company, and it was what it was in terms of pricing, EPL, you can see widely varying pricing. In fact, when I was quoting, pricing for here, I got quotes ranging from $500 a month all the way up to $3,000 a month for the exact same service from different providers. So that would be my tip.
Is EPL, Ethernet Private Line, is that similar to or the same thing as what some people call Metro Ethernet?
I think that is another name for it. EPL or okay. Ethernet Private Line is the term that Comcast uses for it, and that's gotcha. The provider that we're using here.
Gotcha. And so this is not an ordinary internet connection. It's a point-to-point Ethernet connection that they engineer.
It is, and we have one out here, a 10-meg EPL that's actually carrying four channels of 48K uncompressed linear audio via a pair of Axia nodes out here from our studios, and it's great. and it cost a whole lot less than the T1 frames that it replaced.
And except for the EPL, I'm doing the same thing at my station, at some of my stations in Mississippi, where we already had Axia at one end. We bought a node for the other end and, hooked it up with an IP radio. But you're doing the same thing with a wired engineered service that's provided to you called EPL. Very cool.
We are, and we actually have some Ubiquiti radios that are running an 11.9-mile hop between this facility and our studios. We use those for data, and actually our HD2 stuff's all transported out here. But, since we already had wireless STL in terms of our 950 megahertz links, the EPL provides our wired link. We like to have the redundancy of having two different kinds, because we really, really... it makes people nervous whenever there's dead air in this market.
Sure.
So we try to avoid it at all costs.
I hear you. All right. Thanks for that, Robbie. Appreciate it. Chris Tobin, what tip would you like to leave us with today?
Well, I'm going to go with the preventive maintenance tip today. It's that time of year for us in the Northeast where the cold weather moves out and the warm weather starts to roll in. For those of you in the warmer parts of the country and the world, you don't go through probably as much preventive maintenance as you should because the warm weather makes you feel good. I just recently did some PM work with the station on their HVACs, both heating and cooling. And a good thing to do is always remember to keep a stock of filters, belts for the blowers, and then the good old emergency, aluminum tape. If you have a system that provides heat for your studios or offices, remember the flexible gas hose can sometimes fatigue and find a crack in it. Working with a group that just recently, we discovered a small gas leak on the rooftop of a unit going, oh, that's not a good sign. So these are things to consider for preventive maintenance, and it's at that time of year again for everyone to start looking around, checking stuff that you forget, out of sight, out of mind. And the one thing we always overlook, we talk about heating and cooling and transmitter sites. Look at those boxes physically. Just don't feel the air coming out of the ductwork. Make sure. And also be prepared to clean out the condenser fins. When they fill up with dirt, the efficiencies drop considerably, and before you know it, nothing works right. So that's what I would say.
That's a good thing. Actually, it's on my calendar here at Harnack House 4 times a year. It's on my calendar to clean the outdoor air conditioner units. And okay, if it's a really nasty day, I mean, 4 times a year may be a little overkill. But hey, if it's a nice day, I get the garden hose out and I go spray the spray water through the outdoor units and get them cleaned out. And of course, I replace the indoor air filters pretty often. Well, good maintenance idea. You're right. Go look at them. Nothing beats a an eyeball inspection.
Well, yeah,
Robbie
Green,
and
the leaking gas. We smelled the gas. That's when we realized there was a problem.
yeah. By the way, Chris, if you ever decide to move here to the South, you only need two preventive maintenance items. You can carry them both in a small sack. You need WD-40 and duct tape. That fixes it.
I thought you were going to tell me Redbreast, but okay, fine.
If it moves and it's not supposed to, duct tape. If it doesn't move and it's supposed to, WD-40.
Excellent. I like that.
Robbie, isn't that what you do? You're south of the Mason-Dixon there in Houston. Isn't that what you do?
Yeah, all my life. All my life, Chris. It's duct tape and WD-40. I learned it from my old man, so.
There you go. There you go. Hey, thanks, everybody, for joining us on This Week in Radio Tech. Robbie Green, the market chief engineer for CBS in Houston. Appreciate you being with us, Robbie.
Thanks, Kirk. It's been a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
And I hope to have you back again sometime.
Absolutely.
And Chris anytime. Tobin from the rooftop in Newark. Thanks for joining us, Chris. We really appreciate it.
No problem. I'm looking forward to it. Temperature's dropping quickly, and the weather is changing very fast. So I guess tomorrow will be a snowy, rainy day.
You might get that 6 inches of snow. I was just looking at the probabilistic weather forecast. How about that from the Weather Prediction Center? The probabilistic winter precip guidance. Oh man, you're looking at some. You've got a 90% chance. Wait a minute. Let me look at it here. Now, actually, it may not be that much. You have about a 80% chance of greater than 2 inches of snow, and this is by Saturday afternoon. So you're going to get it all Friday night and Saturday morning.
Nice, excellent.
Well, there you go. There you go. You snowed in for the weekend. Yeah,
excellent.
Exactly.
I got my French press. Have some for my breakfast. It's good.
Next week, our guest is Jim Gray, and Jim has some amazing stories to tell. I don't think he can tell all of them because a couple of them are top secret. But anyway, he'll tell us the broadcasting stories. Not all of them are top secret. Thanks a lot to Suncast for producing this week's edition of This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks, of course, to Chris Tobin for being my co-host, and appreciate him being here. And to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network, where you'll find lots of other fine podcasts. Tell your friends, hit subscribe, and we'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.